Hello. Before you start this episode of The Game Changers, I wanted to take a moment to tell you about our new documentary, Abby Ward, A Bump in the Road, which explores the challenges faced by professional female athletes and all working mothers. It follows the remarkable journey of an England rugby player as she battles back to the professional game just 17 weeks after the birth of her baby, and then on to secure her place in England's Six Nations squad for 2024. The documentary is free to watch in the UK on ITVX or globally on Rugby Pass TV. And don't forget that our other documentary, Game On, The Unstoppable Rise of Women's Sport, is still available to watch on Netflix in the UK. Now it's time for the Game Changers. Hello and welcome to The Game Changers, the podcast where you'll hear from extraordinary women in sport. I'm Sue Anstis, a founding trustee of the Women's Sport Trust charity and the founder of Fearless Women, a company with a powerful ambition to drive positive change for women's sport. I am thrilled to say that once again, this series of The Game Changers is supported by Barclays and will focus on fearless women in football. In each of the 8 episodes, I'll be talking to a trailblazing woman, reinforcing Barclays' huge commitment to the beautiful game. In 2019, Barclays announced the largest ever commercial investment in women's sport in the UK. The Barclays FAWSL is now Europe's first fully professional women's football league, and their investment will also help the future growth of the league and its clubs. Along with its fantastic support for women's professional sport, Barclays also invested in establishing the Girls Football School Partnerships with the aim of ensuring that all girls in England will have equal access to football in schools by 2024. My guest today is Steph Horton, MBE, captain of the Lionesses and Man City. Steph's represented her country at every level with over 100 appearances for England. She's also led Man City to 2 Women's FA Cups, 3 Continental Cup successes, and the FA Women's Super League title, as well as landing the PFA's Merit Award in 2019. Representing Team GB at the London 2012 Olympics, Steph became a household name by scoring in all 3 group matches, including the winning goals against New Zealand and Brazil. Steph proudly led the Lionesses to their World Cup semi-final last year in France, watched at home by almost 12 million viewers. I began by asking Steph how football first became a part of her life.
Yeah, I think it was from my dad, really. I think, obviously, he's one of 7 boys in the family, and they were all football mad. I'm from the Northeast, which is very much of a football hotbed, and I think as soon as I could run or I could walk, it was kind of like a football at my feet. And my first ever memory was just playing football in the backyard with my dad, really.
And did you play other sports? Did you love other sports as well?
Yeah, I love sports, even still now. I mean, obviously watching sports on the telly or whether we have daft little games of football and stuff, it's nice to do something a bit different. But I'm from a village, so we had a cricket field there. Used to play cricket, used to do taekwondo. Obviously, at school, you do a lot of sports there. So whatever, whether it was athletics, netball, it was always kind of like, right, I'm just going to go and try and do every club as I possibly can.
And did you stand apart a little bit from other girls that were there in terms of your love of football?
I think my love of football, I think it's probably still the same as it is now. I just love the game, whether it's playing, watching, talking about it. It's obviously something that's my life now. But obviously, at the time, I think probably the thing that stood out was probably my competitive edge. I think when I was younger, still the same now, I love to win and hate losing, the worst loser ever. So I think in terms of the other girls I played, they obviously love football, but at the same time, I think if it was a choice of being on a 5-a-side team, I think the boys would probably pick me because they knew that I'd like to get stuck in or I'd give us more of a chance of winning, which obviously I try and take into my games now.
Were other girls playing in school with you then? As you say, the Northeast was a bit of a sort of hotbed for women's football.
Yeah, like obviously my best friend, who's my cousin, Amy, she loves football as well. And when we were growing up, it was always me and her playing football, whether it was in the yard, in the street or at school. My other best mate, Lauren, who was a year below, we all kind of grew up together. Our families were really close, and there was always a group of 6, 7, 8 of us that would always go and play five-a-side on a Sunday with our parents just to make it 10. And I think having them there gave us a little bit more confidence as well, because obviously there's other girls that love the sport that I do, but they chose different career paths, but I'm sure they could have made it if they wanted to and the opportunity was there. But I think for me at that age, it was just all about trying to, at the time I couldn't really have that as a job, but at the same time I knew I always wanted to play and I always knew I wanted it to be my hobby.
And what did you want to do when you were growing up? Did you have other things in mind?
I think it would have been sport. I think PE teacher probably. Yeah. I think obviously I love PE. That was probably the only lesson I really did like. And just to get out of the classroom and do something a little bit active, I think that was always something that I wanted to do. And my parents were really strong on us getting an education after school and going to sixth form and going to university, because at the time, obviously, women's football wasn't as big as it is now. So I think that's really stood us in good stead in terms of, obviously, after football as well, getting a degree and all the qualifications to do what I potentially might want to do after football.
Do you remember any female role models, either sort of sporting role models at all when you were growing up?
Not so much. I think not in the young years. I think there wasn't really in terms of female footballers to look up to. And yeah. I think for me, it was always David Beckham, Steven Gerrard. I was a Sunderland fan, so used to have all the Sunderland shirts with his name on my back. And at the time, I was a striker as well, so you try and copy what he does. But yeah, I think obviously when you get a little bit older and you're getting more into your football and there's more games on television, the likes of Kelly Smith and Faye White, Rachel Yankee were the obvious names to kind of stand out and try and aspire to be.
Excellent. And then obviously you came to play with them later on in your career, or some of them anyway as well.
To be on the same team as the likes of Kelly, who is probably, and nobody will ever be as good as her in this country, definitely one of the best players in the world. And the same as Faye White, unbelievable leader in terms of she took us under her wing and really looked after us when I first went to the England squad. And Yanks is just Yanks. She's just unbelievable in terms of her personality, but also her deliveries on the pitch, her consistency in games. And I was fortunate enough to play with them in England, but also at Arsenal as well. So I'm very lucky.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned Sunderland then, and it was Sunderland ladies, I think, that came to look out for you when you were only about 10 or so. So how did that feel at the time, so young?
Yeah, I mean, it was, you never ever think it would ever happen, because at the time we were on an Easter holiday football course. So right. One of them ones where your mum and dad send you away for a couple of days to go and play football and get you out of the house and you pay 10 quid a day or whatever it might be. So me and my best mates, Amy and Lauren, we always used to go, and a lot of the lads from the street used to go as well. And it was just 5, 6 hours of playing football every day. And yeah. I think obviously the more you go to them, the more you get a little bit more confident. And luckily that day there was a scout there from Sunderland who asked us if I wanted to go and train with one of the women's teams. And the fact I was 10 and yeah. I was potentially going to play with players that were a lot older than me, I couldn't really say no. And obviously as a Sunderland fan, and I think my mum's got a little picture of it where I'm going to receive a certificate of the guy who obviously said, do you want to come and train with us, kind of thing. So it was obviously a really special moment and something that you never think of, but to play for your club that you support was a dream come true.
And how did that feel? You mentioned like playing with adults, with grown women. Was that quite a bit of a shock? You're almost like, I guess, a youngster coming into that environment.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's quite daunting, isn't it? Yeah. I think obviously those players have been there for a long time. They're obviously a lot bigger, physically stronger than you. And it is a bit scary, but at the same time, I think I look back at that now and I think about all these youngsters that are coming through the squad, and you need to be challenged, you need to be taken out of your comfort zone. And I think mine was probably a little bit earlier than a lot of young girls coming through the system now. But at the same time, you have to be stronger. It's kind of like sink or swim. And for me, I was fortunate enough to have some amazing people around us, amazing coaches, and the likes of me and Jill Scott, Carly Telford, we were kind of growing up at the same time and we had each other to kind of lean on. But at the same time, when you're from the Northeast, you'd like to say that they're all nice people. So,
and we did say, you both said that kind of hotbed in the Northeast there. So why do you think that was specifically for women's football? Because it does, I mean, you've reeled off a few names there that went on to play for England. Why do you think that was, do you think, on the women's game?
I think in terms of the coaching that we received was ridiculous. I think in terms of the quality, we only ever used to train once, twice a week. We hardly had any games, and the competitiveness, the love of football. And it wasn't just about them two train sessions. It was about what you did when you went back home. And I know for all the girls who are in the England squad now that are from the Northeast, I know it was just not a case of just have them two train sessions, just chill, watch telly. It was always about try to improve yourself, try and go and play with your mates in the street. And I like to think, like, the one thing that I'd like everybody to describe us as a Northeast bunch would be that we're hard working. Yeah. And I think that shows on and off the pitch, really.
And you moved to Leeds and then down to Arsenal to play in the yeah. Super League. How tough was it then to move down to London, to move away from the home environment at that time?
Yeah, I mean, obviously I was at Leeds and I was at uni at the time. I was kind of used to potentially living away a little bit, but I used to go back every weekend to play for Leeds. A few years before, I had an opportunity to go to Arsenal and I just didn't feel it was right. I felt I needed to play. I needed to probably go out there, play a few more years of first team football, lose a few games, win a few games, grow up a little bit. And the chance came along to go to Arsenal, and it was something I couldn't really turn down. I wanted to win trophies. I knew I wasn't guaranteed to play every single game. The squad was full of England internationals, other internationals that had got over 100 caps and won loads of trophies at Arsenal. But for me, I felt it was right. And yeah, it was daunting. I mean, taking a Northeast girl out of the Northeast and going 4 or 5 hours away.
Yeah.
But look, I think that's what the type of club Arsenal were. They made sure I was okay. They looked after us. Vic Akers was unbelievable with us getting sorted with my flat, my accommodation. The girls were amazing as well. And I made some amazing friends down there.
And you were made captain. So how long into your time there were you made captain?
It was my third year. So I would have been 25. It was just before I moved to City. So a new manager came in and obviously there was a lot of changes. And Kelly Smith was originally the captain, but at the time she had a few injuries. And then I was asked to be vice captain, which was a surprise.
Right.
But at the same time, it was something that I couldn't really turn down. And I felt as though I had the qualities going forward to become captain eventually in the future, whatever club I was at. And obviously at the time it was Arsenal.
And how did that change your perception, I guess your feeling towards the game and the team as well, becoming captain?
I think you feel as though you've got a little bit more responsibility on your shoulders. I think for me, I care so much. And when I play football, it's not just about myself. It's about my team. And I want to make them happy. And I want to make my performances count for the team. And if there's something happening, I'll always try and maybe I get involved a little bit too much. But it's because I care and I want us to win. And ultimately, I think when you love the game so much and you know that you're a role model and you've got young players underneath you, you've got to try and do everything you can to make this game even better than what it is now. And I'd probably take that role really seriously.
Excellent. How much were you training and playing then? So you mentioned when you're at Leeds, it's a couple of nights a week, as it were. It's Sunderland, rather. But by this time at Arsenal, how much were you training then?
Probably 3 or 4 times a week, right. And obviously a game as well. So we were starting to increase the training load, really. And I think the fact that we were in Champions League as well, there was a lot more training times because we had so many more games to prepare for as well. But obviously that was the dream, was to go there and to be able to train on the ball more and train with all the players of a world-class level.
And you became full-time professional with the new Man City Women, as it was then, in 2014. So how do you feel your life changed then to become fully professional? What difference did that make to you?
Oh, it was a massive change, but I knew I needed to make the change, I think. For me, there was lots of things going on. Obviously, I love my time at Arsenal, the unbelievable club, and I was playing, I was captain. So in that sense, I was fine on the pitch, but I felt I just needed to push myself a little bit more, and the opportunity to move to Man City kind of came around. It was a bit random and a bit not really expected, but obviously speaking to my agent, my family, and a chance to move up home, towards home anywhere, and start a new life and a new chapter. And at the time we didn't really have an England manager, so it was kind of like, right, okay, like I need to challenge myself in so many different ways. And Man City offered to give us full-time football, and the facilities we have up here are second to none, and I could see the vision over the next 4 or 5 years. And sometimes it's hard when you're in that moment because nothing's built yet, and But I really wanted to buy in. I really wanted to be there from the start and to be captain of this club. And as you said, the rest kind of history.
Yeah, I saw one of the videos of you giving a bit of a tour of the facilities. It is quite extraordinary, isn't it? Just breathtaking.
Yeah, you have to pinch yourself. I think obviously now in moments like this when you're in lockdown, and I think obviously sometimes when it gets a bit hectic, it gets a bit busy, just I just want to be home. But I think you start to appreciate what you really have, and not only the facilities but the people that we have at the club. I think it's a very family orientated club. You come in, everybody makes you feel welcome. Like, I feel like they're my family. I miss them today. And even just to have a chat to whoever it is in the canteen or the receptionist, just to see how they are, it just makes it feel like home.
And you've been England captain, I think, for 6 years now, and obviously you're captain at Man City too. So what is it, do you think, that makes you a good captain?
I think I'd like to think it's probably my professionalism. I think the way that I apply myself every single day, it's something that I really pride myself on, and I give everything, whatever it may be, even if it's a warm-up, a cool-down, recovery, on the pitch. I like to lead by example. I think over the years, I think I've improved a lot in different areas. I think you don't have it straight away. And at the time I got the captaincy, I was 26. I had to lean on a lot of people. It probably was really tough at first, but at the same time, you have to kind of go through their moments and come out of the other side. And I feel comfortable with how I am. And I like to inspire people, whether that's through talking, whether that's through my performances. And I'm not scared to tell people off either. Something that I probably could be better at, but I'd like to think that my standards is as high as anybody else's. And for me, the expectation is for everybody else to kind of try and reach that standard. And I think you've got to be realistic that some people might not get there, but if you can see the intention, then that's the best thing that we can hope for.
And do you feel that you're a different captain when you're a captain of Lionesses than when you're a club captain at Man City?
Yeah, I think for me, I think at Man City, I find it a lot easier. I'll be honest. I think I go in there, I'm like just another one of the girls in terms of you see them every single day. My role is not as heavy as it probably is in England. I think when you go away with England, you only see your teammates for 10, 12 days. And in that period, you've got so much work to do. You've got so much catching up to do. You've got to kind of switch your mindset to England mindset. You've got to adapt to what the coach wants you to do, what the there's a different group of girls. So sometimes it's quite hard to adapt. But at the same time, once you've kind of got over them first 2-3 days, it's kind of becomes natural. And for me, football always comes first. So regardless of whether I've got an armband on or I'm named captain of England, for me, I need to just let my football do the talking. And that's what I've always got to just focus on.
And do you ever wish you could just be a regular member of a team and not have that responsibility of captaincy?
Sometimes, yeah, of course, like when there's problems and obviously you've got to do a lot more media. And but look, I'm fortunate enough to be captain of my country and captain of an unbelievable football club. So for me, I'm not going to sit here and go, I wish I was just somebody else. But I do get what you mean. I think there's times when there's been some tough moments, and especially when the pressure's on, people do look at the captain or they do look at the bigger players. And sometimes you just like, right, okay, well, actually, my performance was actually good. So, but I understand why you're trying to put the blame on somebody else. So for me, I think the most important opinions I listen to is my family and obviously my two managers.
You became a bit of a household name, really, I guess, in terms of London 2012 and those amazing goals you scored in all three of the group matches. So can you just share, I guess, some of the biggest memories that you had from the London Olympics?
Oh, the Olympics was crazy. Unbelievable. I think people always say, like, what's a World Cup like? And World Cup is unreal, but Olympics was just, it's just a different feeling. I think the first ever Olympics that a Team GB women's football team's been involved in, things like the kitting out process, being in the village with all the other athletes, you don't become important. It's weird, like, whereas if we're a football team in a World Cup, there's a lot of focus on you as a team and as an individual, whereas when you're as part of Team GB, everybody's just the same, no matter who you are. And it was a really nice feeling to see people going out to train and people preparing for the competitions. The memories from that is obviously the first ever game to open the Olympics as well at Millennium Stadium was special.
Yeah, yeah.
And then obviously the Brazil game at Wembley was where dreams come true, I think. Yeah, that goal. I don't know what was the matter with us, that tournament. Everything I touched went in the back of the net, so
Did you feel things change then? I mean, people do talk about, don't they, forever, that tipping point. But it does feel like from that moment, in terms of the public consciousness, women's football changed. Do you think that was a really key moment?
Yeah, of course. I think if you think back to that Brazil game alone, I think to get that many people in Wembley Stadium, yeah. I don't think anybody expected that. That was just the pull of the Team GB. I don't think it was necessarily us. It was just kind of the whole country wanting to go and see some Olympic sports. And we were lucky enough that over 70,000 came to watch us. Yeah. But and I always remember my mum, she got the train down to London and then obviously got the tube to Wembley on the way back, obviously after scoring the goal. She was just like, people were reenacting your goal. They were shouting at you. They were saying your name and stuff. And like, I think from then on, people were actually starting to talk about women's football, which I think from then we've kind of not really looked back.
How amazing for her to experience that. I was going to ask you how your life changed after the tournament, but I guess her as your mum also, and then hearing your kind of fame really changed too.
Yeah, it was mental. I think obviously all the papers, all my friends were keeping the paper, my grandma was keeping the papers on the back pages. Then I think there was a lot more media attention. There was a lot more people wanting to do appearances. Yeah. And that's when I first got my agent, because I didn't really have a clue what was going on. I'm just doing appearances at Arsenal. I'm just doing whatever they're asking us to do. But I think that's when a lot of the girls' lives maybe changed. Yeah. I think because we're out there, people knew our names and a lot more girls want to start playing football.
And how did that feel then, I guess, to be that new role model to that next generation of girls then?
I think you kind of consciously think about what you're doing. I think in terms of whether it was on social media or the interviews you gave, it was kind of like you wanted to kind of give out a little bit of a message and you were living their dream that they wanted to be. So I think first and foremost is just to be myself. I think it's important that people see us as normal people. And I come from the Northeast. I come from a mining village. I've worked hard to get where I am, and anything is possible if you put your mind to it. So for me, it was just all about trying to show my personality and be the footballer that I was.
How do you deal with the negative bits in terms of the media and I guess social media now, more so even, isn't it, the last 5 years? How do you personally deal with that when there's negativity?
It's quite hard, I think. The older I've got, the lot better I've got in terms of being able to kind of block it out. And obviously you do a lot of work with the psychologists in terms of making sure you're checking in, and the stuff that's probably affected us that should never really affect you. But
absolutely,
I'm not stupid enough to know that the media kind of can create something out of nothing. Yeah. And I think for me, you just got to kind of go back to the facts and concentrate on your own game. And sometimes the media might be right, but at the same time, sometimes they're definitely trying to just either create a story or say something to kind of create something else as well.
Controversy. I think you're right, as long as you're authentic and so on. And is there any advice you'd give to the young up-and-coming female players now that are getting more profile and will kind of be where you are in a decade's time in terms of social media?
Yeah, I think it's all about consistency and realising that there's going to be people that really build you up to a certain level, and then there's going to be people that are as quick to throw you back down. So for me, I think it's just kind of staying on that level where, you know, you're very comfortable. I think obviously when the highs do come, I think enjoy them. But at the same time, in football, the football works funny ways, and sometimes there's a low around the corner and you've got to just kind of stay focused on you. And football always first for me. I think that's why I've kind of...
Excellent.
I can always remember having that conversation with my agent. It's always football, you know, whether it's appearances, whatever it might be for your sponsors. I think if nothing's right on the pitch and you're not playing well, you have to kind of strip it all back and get back to the basics.
Excellent. I see you've been a trailblazer on so many levels, but in 2014, you were the first woman to appear on the front cover of Shoot.
Yeah.
How did that feel at the time? It really kind of really was something.
Yeah, it was cool. I think obviously that came through City as well, and I think moving to a club like that, I knew that there was going to be a lot more opportunities in that sense of stuff like that. And I think for me it was a bit mad because every Christmas I'd always get a Shoot annual. Me and my brother would always fight over it, whoever it was, and if it'd been placed on your couch or whatever it was always, that's my Shoot annual. So to be on the cover was amazing, not just for myself but also for women's football, to kind of get out and to get into football magazines like that.
That's so good to hear. And you were obviously at the most magnificent tournament last year in France last summer. And again, we talked about London 2012, but a further transformation of the public's perception. Were you aware as players when you were out in France just how much it was getting picked up at home, or were you in a bit more of a bubble?
I think when you're in a tournament like that, you do get into a bubble. I think it's kind of like you're moving hotel all the time. You just focus on the next game. I think when the family start to come out, you kind of realise that it is starting to build up a little bit at home, and people are tweeting in, Instagramming, obviously the flags outside the house, them watching the games, and we're getting fed back how many people are like watching us back home, and we're breaking all these record viewing figures. And until you kind of hear them stats, you kind of don't really realise because you're so focused. I mean, other people might be different, but from my point of view, it was kind of like, okay, we've got 7 weeks. You're counting down the days. Me and my roommate Ellen are like, right, okay, 3 more days to the next game. Then it's a week to the quarterfinal, then 10 days to the semi-final. So you're kind of counting down, but at the same time, you're just so focused on being mentally right and obviously physically right for the games coming up.
Absolutely. And clearly, you've said in the past, not an amazing whole tranche of games really that got you to that semi-final, but you said you won't be personally defined, as it were, by that missed penalty in the
yeah.
How do you deal with that? Do you have psychologists that help you to put that to the back of your mind or not deal with that?
I think obviously people do ask us about it a lot, and I don't really think about it every single day, or obviously as time's gone on, you kind of put it to the back of your mind, and until maybe you see a highlight of the World Cup and you're thinking, oh no, never mind, like whatever it might be. But for me, like I've said before, I think I know for a fact that I had a good tournament in France and played every single game. I had an opportunity to take a penalty I missed, and that emotional part of you goes, well, if you just scored that, then we would have potentially been in the final. But look, it's football. I remember in 2015, I saved one off the line to keep us in the game. So it kind of works around like that. But for me, I've got the right people around us, and I'm just focused on playing as well as I can.
Absolutely. And we've said many times, obviously 11.7 million people watching the Lionesses in that semi-final. But those numbers perhaps haven't translated into the WSL in terms of fan numbers and engagement. What do you think would you like to be seen to be done to increase that further, so to build up those numbers when we're back playing?
Oh yeah, exactly, when we're back playing. No, I think for me, I think we need to try and find a regular slot and where all these games are played. And I get that sometimes for television purposes, the games are changed. And I think when these games get changed quite late on, it's quite hard for then fans to then adjust when they're going to go and watch the games. Obviously, it's hard as well with the men in terms of the clashes of their games as well. But at the same time, we can promote them so much more better, and we can get them out there. We can really push them hard as much as we possibly can, because I think it's more about people knowing when the game is rather than people wanting to actually come. And the tickets are cheap enough. People have got an opportunity to come to, say, for example, a lot of Man City fans have got an opportunity to come and watch the women play. We play exactly the same as the men. We play an unbelievable stadium. The facilities are ridiculous. We have pre-match entertainment. So it's more of trying to get people to the game, and once they're there, they'll enjoy it anyway.
Absolutely. That's so good to hear. And you're clearly at the top of your game, but are there elements that you're still working on that you'd like to improve as a player?
Yeah, everything really. I think for me, I think getting a little bit older now, but I still feel as fit as I've ever been. And this is for me is an opportunity through lockdown is to strive to be even better and to get stronger, to get out on the pitch, do all my running, and I'm going to start adding a little bit of Pilates and more yoga and just experiment a little bit. I'm constantly on the phone to the Man City sports scientist, the England sports scientist. I'm trying to find different ways to, probably sick of us messaging, but at the same time, I'm like, I want to use as much opportunity as I can to be even better. And I don't think anybody can sit in a seat like this and say, no, I don't need to work on anything, because we all have something to work on.
Absolutely. And you do a fantastic amount for charities. And one of them I'm really interested in is you're an ambassador for Period Poverty Campaign. Can you just tell us a little bit about that?
Well, of course. So basically, obviously, people that are a bit less privileged than what we are in terms of having the access to the tampons or the pads, I think it was important for us to try and encourage girls to continue playing sport, and that period shouldn't be really able to affect you playing the sport that you want to do, or yeah. being in school and doing PE. I think it's important that we strive to encourage young girls to play, and even though we do have periods, it's important that we can still do whatever we want to do, and that should never ever be able to stop us.
Excellent, excellent. It's really good to hear. And moving on to other roles that you're taking us off the pitch, off the grass, you were the first female pundit on Sky. How was that for you as an experience at the time, the first time?
Oh, it was an unreal experience, I think. for me to get that opportunity was, I was a surprise, but at the same time, I'm always watching all the football on the telly. I always watch Monday Night Football, Super Sunday when we're not playing, and for me, I love talking about football, so it gave us an opportunity to do so. And every time I go on, I know I get a little bit more confident. I feel more comfortable with the presenter or pundits that are next to us, and they make you feel really welcome. So it's definitely something that I'd love to do in the future.
That answered my next question, really, for me. That was going to be that is something you'd like to do more of. And would you like to do more of it kind of on a full-time, full-on basis after playing? Do you think about what you'll do after the game?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to be still involved at Man City. I think that's ultimately the aim, is to, or England. I don't know whether that'll be in a coaching role, but I think in terms of how the programme looks, working with players, I don't really know what you would call that role, but I think for me, it's just kind of getting my head around that I want to be involved and keep developing the game. I think at the first team elite level, and obviously the punditry stuff is something that I'm going to look into and try and keep my foot in the door with Sky and try and do stuff when the football returns in the next few months.
Excellent. And have you done your coaching badges? Are you coaching at all now? Are you?
Yeah, I've done. I'm doing my level, my B license at the moment. So there's a few of us at the club doing it. So I'm still going to do it just in case anything kind of crops up. But for me, I don't really feel as though my desire is to be on the grass every single day coaching. I think I'd get too jealous and just want to play anyway.
Excellent. And we've heard a lot recently, haven't we, about more female players, even in the last few weeks, around the prevalence of ACL injuries. And Kim, you've had your own experience of, you know, injuries, knee injuries, etc. Do you feel the more should be being done for women, for the, I guess, the difference in the women's bodies and performance in terms of the likelihood of injuries?
I think for me, if I look back on my own experience with ACL, I think mine was a contact injury. And I think no matter how much prevention I did in the gym, it was just one of them things, regardless of whether I was female. It just happened. And I think in the women's game, we're always trying to strive for perfection and we're trying to improve. And we're getting there with the types of facilities that we have got now. We've obviously got St George's Park, we've got we're supported by the PFA, and if people do get injured, they can go and use the performance center at St George's. And I'm at Man City, where we've got unbelievable physios and an unbelievable medical department. And I think for me, I think it's, if you look at the clubs that are lower down, I think it's how much support they get. And I think as a sport, I think we need to strive to give everybody as many opportunities as you possibly can throughout the leagues rather than just the top league itself.
Yeah, absolutely. And you were out for nearly a year, I think, with your injury when you were about 21 or so. So how did you deal with that psychologically, to be away from the game for so long?
It was tough, obviously. I needed two operations for my knee because it was that mashed up. I'd obviously done my ACL, which was totally ruptured. I'd pretty much nearly ruptured my medial ligament, so I'd end up getting an operation on my medial ligament. So that was 6 weeks to rehab that. But ultimately, in the longer term, it would mean that my knee was in a better condition. I was learning I was going to miss out on another major tournament for England where I probably would have been starting. That was two tournaments in a row. So mentally, it was tough. But I think I can always remember having a conversation with my dad, and he was just like, look, Steph, like, this is your training now. It's not, it's a different type of training. You've got to do your rehab exercise. You've got to do everything. You've got to. And I was lucky enough to be supported by EAS, and with England, they were brilliant with us. They got us the best surgeon in the country. I rehabbed. Obviously, there's ups and downs with rehab. Sometimes it doesn't go as smooth. But at the same time, I think I had to go through that year of probably getting physically stronger. It probably made us mentally stronger as well to then come back. And I think even though I was out of football for a year, I think it still probably takes you another 4 months after that to kind of get back into where you are and the player you were.
Excellent. And Man City, so 2018, I think they launched the Same City, Same Passion campaign. So wanted to show fans the similarities really to the men's game are much more likely than they are different from a women's point of view. And mm-hmm. actually men's, women's, boys and girls football can be enjoyed by all fans. So what have you seen change across women's football in the 6 years that you've been there? Have you seen a real difference?
Yeah, a massive difference. I think you see a lot more men coming to watch our games, whereas probably previously you'd probably get mums bringing their young girls to come and watch us. And even when we're going to the stadium and you see all the fans walking in, you see little boys with your name on the top on their top, which is cool. And I think for me to have that, I think that just typifies the club, really. I think the way that they support the men's team, the women's team, the EDS, the academy boys and girls, I think it's all about, if you play for Man City, you represent our club and we'll give you every opportunity to be the best player you can. And that's shown without all the age groups throughout the whole club.
That's fantastic, isn't it? And what do you think other clubs can learn from the attitude of Man City? Because it does feel from an outsider like they really have set themselves apart in terms of their support of the women's team.
I think they've shown that if you give the backing to whether you're male or female, you can be successful. And we've shown that over a number of years. I think we're consistently winning trophies on both sides of the game. And I think it is possible to share the same facility. And we have an unbelievable facility, the CFA, which allows us to be world-class footballers, allows us to have an opportunity to be the best. And ultimately, then it's down to the players. So I think for us, it's just that family feel, that togetherness feel, that no matter, once you put that Man City top on, they want you to be as successful as ever.
Yeah. Amazing, isn't it? And so just in closing, if you were able to look back on that 10-year-old self that went off to Sunderland, scouted there, is there any advice that you'd give yourself then or young girls coming through now?
First of all, just work as hard as you possibly can in everything that you do. And don't worry about what others think. As you grow a little bit older, and obviously there's a lot more people speaking about the game, I think the more you worry about what other people think, it can kind of detract you from your own game. So for me, it's just all about focusing on you and what you can do to help your team win.
Thanks so much to Steph for taking the time to talk to me. I'm sure she'll keep inspiring many young girls and boys to work hard to achieve their dreams. Thanks also to Barclays for their kind support of the Game Changers, which enables us to share the stories of these amazing women with audiences all over the world. And thanks also to Sam Walker from What Goes On Media, who is the fabulous executive producer for the Game Changers podcast. You can find out more about all my guests from this and the previous series at fearlesswomen.co.uk. If you're enjoying the podcast, please do leave us a review. It really does make a big difference. Or you can get in touch on social media on Twitter, Facebook or Instagram at Sue Anstis or at The Game Changers. Next week, I have the absolute privilege of talking to Moya Dodd, one of the most influential women in global sport. Former vice-captain of the Australian women's football team, Moya served on the board of Football Federation Australia and Asian football's governing body before she became one of the first women to join the FIFA Council, where she took a lead role on gender reforms.
This whole idea that there is no demand to watch women's play sport is the biggest fallacy that has been sold to us. That is not something that occurred naturally. That is something that occurred because of the active suppression and eradication of women from the sporting landscape.
The Game Changers. Fearless women in sport.